Welcome to Hallow Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. The flood narrative in Genesis 8 verses 1 through 14 reveals profound insights into God's plan for restoring creation. This study explores the historical context, Hebrew language, and messianic connections in a passage that highlights the ongoing battle against evil and the promise of ultimate triumph. Through a special form of the Hebrew verb for remember in Genesis 8 verse 1 and an important shift in the global calendar from the time of the flood in the Exodus, we gain deeper understanding of what God is doing across time and the role of God's people in preserving the heritage of the Creator. This rich biblical account inspires hope in the Messiah's victory and the restoration of all things.
This continues on with what we were talking about last week. And just to state it very quickly, that again, we're talking about something that is real history. So we had seen with this Genesis chapter 8, where it's talking about flood waters being on the earth and then receding. So this again, what we had talked about last week with the flood waters rising and prevailing upon the earth. And it's a word that you see, it's a form of, you know, like El Gibor, you know, the God of mightiness. Well, that same Gavar or Gabar verb there is something that shows up a lot related to the floodwaters, that the floodwaters are strong, they're mighty. That's why the New American Standard Bible will translate that as prevailed upon. But you could say another word is to overpower that, and that's going to be an interesting thing that we take a look at as we move forward here about the floodwaters overpowering the earth on this. Because really what we've seen with the whole flood thing from the beginning is, we saw that in Genesis chapter 6, the beginning part where it says, because there was all this Hamas or this violence that was upon the earth. So thus, the waters were sent to Gabar, to prevail, to overpower that violence that was upon the earth. So because there was, at the earliest, humans that have descendants upon Adam were spreading violence upon the earth, that had to be stopped. And that's what the floodwaters were doing. So thus, when we saw last week and we saw the passages from Peter's first and second letters, and he talks about those related to the ark and the flood being a judgment, and then also comparing that to the day of the Lord. And we saw that also in the passages related to Matthew, where just like in the days of Noah, so will be the days of the coming of the Son of Man, will be like that as well. Because why? You'll have a same sort of situation, just like before the flood, so it will be in the day of the Lord, is that you will have a large number of the population that will be saying, no, we like the way that things are going. We don't want to have this resetting of the world back to the ways that the Creator of heaven and earth set them up to be. We don't want to go that way. We want to go our own way. So just like what we were talking about, starting with Genesis 4 and then continuing on into the flood, one of the issues with the problem of evil is about this violence. We see it in the animal world, violence. And we saw some of the writings that some of the people that are propagating the ideas related to evolution, because they look out and they see a world that is red in tooth and claw and say, oh, this is just a world where the strong dominate the weak. That is just the way of the world. Well, this is a message from the Creator of heaven and earth, is that no, that might be the way that the strong will try to dominate the whole world, but that is not the way that everything was set up to be, and that won't be the way that it will persist in being over time. So, for example, we've got, and we've talked about this last time, that we have police, we have the military, and what are their main roles to be? I mean, just frankly speaking, they are to use more force than the force coming against them. But in the end result, what do you want? Protection. You want peace to be there. The police are there ideally to not create more chaos, the military is there ideally to not create more chaos and destruction. Now, the problem is that, yes, with the police, if someone doesn't want to comply, go into the handcuffs, go into the jail cell, you're going to have to use more force than they are wanting to to submit to make that happen. If an invading army doesn't want to leave, they don't want to retreat and go back beyond their borders. If they don't want to stop the attacks that they are doing, what then do you have to do? We saw that with some major conflicts we've had. I mean, one that everyone goes back to because it is such a stark contrast between good and evil, and between that which dominates and that which needs to be protected, is World War II. And you see that you have this force that was looking to come in and subjugate. Now, did lots of horrific things happen during World War II in the midst of it? Yes, it did. A whole lot of horrible things happened to it. But in the end, what was the result that came out the other side? That you restore the protection of peace, that you no longer have this raging of that which wants to do violence to dominate those who want peace. So that's one of the best case scenarios that you had of that. So we're seeing true history. We're seeing truly that the creator of heaven and earth is looking to reset the board back and to continue on that promise that came to the woman there in the garden, that her seed was going to be the one that would bring the final justice through. And so that's what we see, the promise to Chava or to Eve, that from her would come the one who would crush the head of the Nahash, or the head of the snake. That the one who brought the violence, who brought the you could say, doubting of our parents, the creator of heaven and earth, the one who brought that power was going to be crushed. The head of the snake, the head of the Nahash, was going to be crushed. And that is the promise that continues to go forward. So thus, we're going to see it yet again, where the head of the snake will continually have to get crushed from one generation to the next, until you had the ultimate crusher of the head with the Messiah comes to ultimately crush that power, that it is no longer the dominion of the snake, the dominion of the adversary, the dominion of the evil one upon the earth and upon all flesh. You saw that battle between the adversary and Yeshua, where he was saying in those temptations, hey, bow down to me. I will give you dominion over the earth. But that wasn't how the dominion over humanity was going to be regained. No. That is not how it was going to be regained. The way that it was going to be regained was through the death, resurrection, and ascension of the Messiah. And those that wanted to trust that way, that the kingdom of the adversary was going to be crushed. That's how it would change. So it gets to our passage that we have here today. So some of the key questions that we have of this is, you know, did the Creator forget the last people and the beasts and the cattle that were left alive during the flood? Here, so we look at Genesis chapter 8, verses 1 through 14. And another question we could ask is, well, when did the flood actually start and ebb and then dry up? When was that this actually happened? So, looking at the first question that we have there, really coming from the first verse. And the first verse that we have there is, Vayizkor Elohim et Noach ve'etz kol ha-chaya ve'etz kol ha-bihama asher ito bateva. So, translated that with the New American Standard, the way it puts it is, but God remembered Noach and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. So that brings here to the key question here is, with that first phrase of Vayizkor Elohim, but God remembered. And we talked about it last week where we were talking about this little, and this is again, looking under the hood, picking up the hood of Hebrew and looking under the hood of the Hebrew text with this form of the verb that's called, the technical term of it is called the Vav consecutive. And in this particular way it shows up is in this Vayizkar. So the root verb that you have here is the Zayin and the Kaf and the Resh. The Z, R. Now this one in particular is in just the active form, which is the call form. So just a very quick little survey. Those that have gone through the Hebrew class can see you can hit your head against the wall in this, but Hebrew kind of has three stem forms of it, and then the other verbs come from that. The call is the basic, it is like the strongest, most basic form of that. So the Vav consecutive, what it does, it is like glue that glues what came before it, or in particular, the ongoing or resultant action that's connected to the previous context. So this glue verb here of Vayizkar, which is that form of the to remember, is telling you that what is following this, but God remembered, is glued to what came right before it. So it can say, this is happening while the what happened before it was happening, or it is a real direct result from it. And we gave the example of where you see this Vav consecutive show up before is right in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And that form of the verb there, vayhaya, is telling you that, and the earth was formless and void, is directly connected to what came before it. And the verse that comes before it, Genesis 1:1, you know, and in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So thus, you've got that glue together, and the earth was formless and void. So telling you, hey, in that part where it's talking, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, in that particular time period, then the earth was formless and void. That's why some people have come up with this idea that there is like billions of years between chapter 1, verse 1 of Genesis and chapter 1, verse 2 of Genesis. The Hebrew does not allow that because of that form of the verb of the Vav consecutive. Because you're saying that in the beginning, with the created the heavens and the earth was formless and void. That was the state of the condition in the beginning there. So, in our particular verse that we're looking at here today, the previous context is Genesis 7, verses 21 through 24. So looking at that, all flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah was left together with those who were with him in the ark. The water prevailed, as that Gabor, the verb again, it prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So that's what was just right before the passage that we're taking a look at here today. So when you're saying in this passage that starts out our passage, Genesis chapter 8, verse 1, and it's saying, but God remembered, that is tied directly to what came before it. So what came before it? All flesh, everything that was alive was now dead. Everything that was outside the ark, gone. And the water was prevailing upon the earth. So that's how you're left with right before this particular situation. The only good part that you have is that Noah and those of his family who were with him on the ark and all of the creatures that were there on the ark, they're land creatures and the birds of the air, they're tied to the land. All of them, they are in the ark and thus safe. But everything else outside of it, gone. And you're left hanging there with the water is prevailing on the earth. So that water that was bringing the judgment, that was wiping away the violence that persisted on the earth up to that particular point in time, that part was taken away. But it still remained, that judgment of the water was still sitting there. So thus, you have the people safe on the ark, but the ark is floating in the water. Now, we have to remember, where did the ark come from? Did it, like in Hollywood wants to say, did Noah just have a hallucination and say, hey, I'm going to build an ark? Is that where the ark came from? He just hallucinated and said, I need to build an ark. No, the Lord said, look, violence is filling the earth. My spirit's not going to strive with mankind. So build this. This is how you're going to build it. Build this. As the fate of humanity is going to be decided here in 120 years. So that was what his directive was. And he went forward with it. He built the boat. And then when that time period came, and it says in the 600th year of Noah's life, then the animals, he was told, hey, go collect these types of animals. Two of each kind of animal. And again, we talked about last time around that when it says kind, it's the Hebrew compound word of baramin, or you could just, it comes from two words. Bara is a form of the verb to create, and it's specifically related to things that God creates, because in the Bible, it is only ever used with what God creates. So thus we see it, you know, in the first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God, bara, he created the heavens and the earth. So that Hebrew compound phrase of bara mean means from. So thus, bara, created, mean, from. So created from. It's like glued word together. So thus, when you use that term after its kind, it means these are the groups of creatures that kind of descend out of the thing that God had created. So thus, it's quite different from what you say the caricature that Darwin and others in the 19th century had come up with, this idea. And there was even some people who weren't overtly going in the direction of Darwin and his philosophy that still had the idea of what came to be known as the fixity of species, that the types of creatures that you see around today were the exact types of creatures that you saw created. Well, the issue is that you see from how animals progress, whether you're talking about breeding, animal husbandry, that you can get different types of creatures. I mean, think of dogs, all of the dogs that we have, you know, genetically, they all come back from one baramin, likely kind of something that was like a wolf. And thus, through breeding, you've gotten all types of dogs, from your Chihuahua or even dogs that are smaller than that, all the way up to gigantic mastiffs and huge dogs, all coming from similar things. Same things with like the cats. You can get all kinds of different cats from a type of wild cat that is found in Africa. So you have the situation that's leading up into Genesis chapter 8, there is all this destruction, and there is the water on the ground. So, what then is going to be the result of this? So thus you see that Genesis 8:1 is bringing this contrast between this domination and destruction of the earth on one side. That's up to this point. That's what you see in Genesis 7, and the salvation and restoration of it. Salvation where? Inside the Teva, or the ark. Inside that ark, that boat, that is preserving the animals and the people. But then what do? The whole world is covered with water. And so thus you see the passage that we have leading up to it is where the water is descending. It starts, it had prevailed, it had gabar, it was strong on the earth, but then the water is going to shuv, is the word for it, is going to return. So we talk about with teshuvah. That is the term that means repentance. It comes from the verb of shuv, which means to turn from where it was. So the water was strong on the earth. It was, and the ark was walking on the water. It was on top of the water. Then you had the water is now going to shuv. It's going to return back to where it was. And a lot of people have done some modeling on this. And where did the water go? Have you ever seen the ocean basins? It's a whole lot of water there. And if you know, people have taken modeling and said, well, what if you just were to raise up the ocean basins, and lower the mountains down, like the Andes and the Himalayas and stuff like that, and what you'd end up with is a covering of the earth to about somewhere between a kilometer and a mile of water all the way over the earth. So, thus, something happened, and you can see with the breaks in the bottom of the ocean that something happened to break things up and create these spaces for the water to drain off. In the midst of the draining, then that's where you see a lot of the erosion and such going, it drained off into the ocean basins. So, thus, when you see this remembering that God remembered Noah, he remembered the animals that were on the ark. Now, we can think of remembering, and this is like getting a little reminder, bing, on your phone. Oh, it's a reminder. So is that kind of what Zachar is telling us, that this is, that it's the creator of heaven and earth just had a little reminder pop up on his phone, so to speak, to remember Noah and everyone on the ark? Rather, what you see, the way that Zachar is used throughout the Bible, is that it is memory that is put into action. It is active memory. So a couple of quotations and citations here from some lexicons. This is from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, talking about the verb of Zachar. There are three groups of meanings. Number one, for a completely inward mental act such as, quote, remembering, unquote, or, quote, paying attention to, unquote. Or number two, for such inward mental acts accompanied by appropriate external acts. And number three, for forms of audible speaking with such meanings as, quote, recite, unquote, or, quote, invoke, unquote. And the cognate evidence, now cognate, that's the big kind of linguistic word. Cognate means these are examples in languages that are similar to Hebrew. So these would be the Semitic family of languages. This would be the Akkadian, the Sumerian. Arabic is a Semitic cousin, Aramaic. So you can look to these other languages and see how similar words are used with, because you're also talking about the similar consonants are showing up. Even though the scripts are different, Arabic script different from the Akkadian cuneiform, different from the Aramaic block script, different from the Hebrew and Canaanite, Phoenician script originally. So they're different, but the consonants are often quite similar. So you can look at how those consonants are used in other languages. And so that if you see these lexicons talking about cognates, that's what they're referring to. So cognate evidence indicates that the third group of meanings is closest to the verb's root meaning. This range of meaning shows the same blending or overlapping between mental states and its external acts seen also in other Hebrew terms. Now, this is important, such as the Hebrew Shema, or to hear. Now, we often talk about, we recite the Shema every day. Shema Yisrael. So, Shema Yisrael, just like Zachar, is not like Shema, okay, listen, okay, I heard it, and then just blah, 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 and in one ear, out the other ear. No, Shema, just like Zachar, is an active sort of thing. So, what is a continual thing that you see throughout the Bible and you see it in the Gospels? Whoever hears and does what? Obeys. So you don't, and you see the Apostle Yaakov says it, who does not just a hearer, but an active doer. So thus, Shema is an active form. So when you hear it in the Bible talking about Shema Yisrael, is not just listen, okay, I got it, and then blah, 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 and then throw it out and go think of something else, go on to whatever. No, this is like, this is critical information here that you need to put into action. So that can almost be similar to some of the things that you see with those commands of hear, O Israel. So listen and put it into action. Same thing with Zachar. So we'll see here another couple of passages from this entry on Zachar from this lexicon here, the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. So, God's remembrance of his covenant results in delivering his people. And it gives an example there of Exodus 2, verse 24, or in preserving them, as found in Leviticus 26, verses 44 and 45. Now, it's interesting to note that passage in Leviticus 26, because that also has a particular verse in Leviticus 26, which is very interesting in the realm of casual listening, because it says, if you treat the Lord with carry, that's the Hebrew form of the word, and that Hebrew word, carry, means by happenstance. You come across it. So the basic meaning of it is, if you treat the Lord just like, okay, well, you're like walking by a house of worship, and it's like, oh, there it is. No, this is, you are supposed to treat the Lord as with intention, that you want to go to the Lord's presence. You want to consult who the Lord is. You want to seek out his presence in your life. You want to seek out his words and what they mean and how to put them into action. So that is a very important thing, because that is how that relationship with the Lord goes. You don't have a casual relationship with the Creator of heaven and earth. So continuing on here, in this passage here from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, quote, conversely, remembering sin may be tantamount to withholding favor, as a passage from Hosea 7, verses 1 and 2. Now, remembering Hezekiah's past faithfulness has resulted in healing, passage from 2 Kings 20, verse 3. And remembering Noah was to make the waters to subside, and our passage we're looking at here in Genesis 8, verse 1. For God not to remember iniquity was to forgive and to withhold further judgment. And from Psalm 79, verses 8 and 9. For men, so that's the way that you see the usage with Zachar related to the Creator of heaven and earth. So for people, and this is where it gets very interesting, and back to our verb of Shema again. So this quote, for men also remembering results in action. Remembering may imply repentance, such as in Ezekiel chapter 6, verse 9, or observing the commandments in Numbers chapter 15, verse 40, especially that of the Sabbath from Exodus 20, verse 8. For the ends of the earth, remembrance is repentance from Psalm 22, 27. In political relations, not remembering a treaty is to break it from Amos 1, verse 9. So that is a very interesting thing. So you see with people, when it talks about remember, so remember the Sabbath day, that's Zachar again. Now, very interestingly enough, the parallel passage for the second generation after the Exodus out of Egypt in Deuteronomy chapter 5, what is the verb that's used there? Shamar. Guard, protect. So here you have it for the first generation, Zachar, the Shabbat. For the second generation, Shamar, the Shabbat. Now, is it like, okay, we're no longer actively remembering it, now we just guard it? Well, how does that work? You know, anyone who's been involved with any sort of protective duty, you know, if you don't remember what it is, the key tasks or the key purposes and such of your mission, how good are you going to be at guarding it? That can be pretty bad if you don't have the active instructions of what it is you're doing, why you're doing it. So for the first generation, hey, remember what this thing is. And for some of them, it may have to be instructed on, and you see that with the progression, leaving Egypt, going through the Red Sea, and after the deliverance through the sea, thus you have what starts on the other shore. You start seeing in Exodus chapter 16. Remember that stuff that came out of the sky when they were crying for bread, the daily bread, manna? Yes. That was part of the first reintroduction of Shabbat. Because you saw, and it records there, that there were people who went out on Shabbat expecting there to be daily bread, just like all the other days, even though there was the instruction, 6 days you're going to get manna. It's going to be there in the morning. But on the sixth day, we call that Friday, there's going to be what? Double the amount, because it is going to last you through Shabbat to, again, the first day of the week. But the interesting thing about it is that it was a miraculous provision, because this manna, if you decided to, oh, I'm going to sleep in, well, what's going to happen if you slept in too late? Because what happens after sunrise to the manna? It said it, what, dissipated, melted, went away. So you truly had to be the early bird. The early bird gets the manna. Kind of mixing metaphors there, but anyway. The idea was that it was going to go away. And if you decided to hoard it from one day to the next, what happened to it? Got rotten. It became disgusting. If you tried to hold it over, hoard it from one day to the next, you were getting your daily bread. Each day you would get provided for that day's needs. That was a part of the training. So then the sixth day of the week, you would get the double portion. But miraculously again, what happened to the manna if you tried to hoard it any other day? It didn't happen on the Shabbat. And so that daily bread would keep you through not only the sixth day, but also the seventh day, and then it would reoccur back on the first day of the week again. So that training of remembering then, so, oh, you've got the provision. You've the one who took you out from the house of bondage, took you through the sea, guarded you, protected you, saved you from the pursuing army, is now giving you daily bread, and is now giving you this cycle saying, hey, the Lord will provide, and you don't have to be out there looking for it on the seventh day, on the Shabbat, because the Lord is going to provide from the sixth day through to the seventh, and then on again. So From that, then, when they get to the mountain and they said to remember, to zachar, the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. And it's also included in their why, because in 6 days, the Lord made heaven and earth. So what else happened 6 days? The manna. So the one who made heaven and earth, everything you see around you, is the same one who's giving you your daily bread. So thus, you can trust, and thus, that is good to remember in. It is a remembrance for it, a remembrance of what the Lord did at the beginning of all things at the creation on the seventh day, and it is a remembrance of the deliverance that is coming through. So that's, you see, why the manna is connected with Shabbat. The one who created is also the sustainer, the provider, and bringing it forward. So that's one of the most important lessons that we can get through this, is that this passage that we're going through in Genesis chapter 8, verses 1 through 14, we can say, okay, this is just kind of a talking, all right, the water goes up, and so the water goes down. The water, the flood waters went up, they became great, they gebor on the earth, and then they shuv, they returned back into somewhere else. Well, you're also talking about the provision of the Lord, that the Lord is providing. And the Lord is protecting, the Lord is saving, and with the shuv, the return of the water, is restoring. Because we see, as this passage is, very short passage is ending, you see that you have the sending out of the dove, and then the sending out of the raven, and that you see that this water is slowly being returning to where it was. So the destruction period is ending. And that's where we get into common parlance, and you could even see it's a, call it a hangover, but it's a holdover from belief in the Bible into popular culture. Because what is one of the things you see as a universal symbol of peace? You used to see it on a lot of even Peace Corps for a while had this. What is it? The dove with what? Olive branch in its beak. And what is that a symbol of? Symbol is taken to be a symbol of peace. And as we've talked about before, shalom, what you translate as peace, is not just a sense of what we stop to reload. No, it is a sense of reaching wholeness. Because shalom, you also have another type of phrase in Hebrew, which is called tamim, which is being complete. So shalom, this kind of reaching completeness, but also tamim, also reaching completeness, wholeness, something that is continuing on, everything is all right. So the question then comes in is, and it's an interesting note, is that it talks about the various phrases in here for when the flood prevailed on the earth and when it went away. It talks about here, it was on the earth for 150 days. And then it says in verse 5, Genesis 8, verse 5, the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month and the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Then verse 6 came about after the end of 40 days. And then he sent out the dove and then the raven. And then it came about in verse 13, in the 601st year. So the flood came in the 600th year. Now the subsiding and the dry land is showing up in the 601st year. It says, in the first month and the first of the month. Now the question, and then it says in the down in verse 14 where it ends, in the second month and the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry earth was parched. So the question comes, what months are these? So that's a very interesting question, because if we were to say verse 13, the first month and the first of the month, what month is that? And the Hebrew calendar, Nisan, yeah, okay. And that's a very interesting thing, because thus you see where the kind of the traditions started developing about this. So you have you probably have heard the tradition about the world being created there on the first day of the seventh month, or what we say now, the first day of the seventh month, and that's the seventh, saying the same one that we have got, you know, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah, that we have Yom Kippur, that we have Sukkot, so Atonement, Tabernacles, that month. So where on earth did that tradition then come from? And partly it comes from this passage right here, because one of the things that some sages had looked about over the years is that, well, why then do you see in Exodus chapter 12 when it says, this is going to be the beginning of months? Well, then what was being referred to here in Genesis chapter 8? So I started them thinking about this. Well, that is a very interesting thing, because you have in other Semitic calendars, like especially in the Akkadian, Sumerians, and whatever, what is their first month? What you call the seventh month. So the interesting thing that a lot of sages then thought about is, well, until the time of the Exodus, until that time of Exodus chapter 12, for a lot of the world that Avraham came from and all the sons and descended down from, the first month of calendar counting was what we call the seventh month. So God put the reset in there in Genesis chapter 12. So that's, you can see where even though it doesn't say in Genesis chapter 1, or I should say in chapter 3 or whatever, what month or whatever this was in creating it, that's where the tradition came from, is that, well, okay, if the world was restored, if you had the restoration, the return of the earth, the dry land, the shuv of the earth, if that happened there in what we call the seventh month, then, well, okay, the earth was created on the seventh month as well. So it also brings up some very interesting things, because no matter if you go with the idea that the flood is this, when it calls the first month, is actually the seventh month. Well, start doing some of the math in what it's talking about here. If this is talking about the seventh month on the first day of the month, and then the second month on the 27th day of the month, and then some of the other dates and months and days that we saw here mentioned earlier, especially like when they went into the ark, what day did it say that was? Yeah, it was there in talking about second month on the 17th day of the month. So it is interesting when you see this. So if you were to say then, if this is the second day, or if the second month comes after the first month, and the first month is actually the seventh month, that would put it as to what? The eighth month. So just an interesting way of looking at the world, in that the God came in and reset some of the thinking of these progression of months, and to why that was a significant thing for giving a message to the entire world. Because you think of it, all of the other Semitic nations, the Sumerians, the Akkadians, and descended down from that, they were all using the calendar that was in what you call the seventh month. So then, what happens then when, with the exiles? Aha! Interesting. Yes, it started following Noah's calendar. So, yeah, what happened with the exiles when all of the people who were in Israel, who had now been given the reset of, hey, this is the beginning of months for you, which is in the springtime, is now, because think about it. What, start counting the months. So if the seventh month is actually called the first month, start counting around it. So you got seventh month, eighth month, ninth month, 10th month, 11th month, 12th month is what? Six. Seventh month is what? First. Very interestingly enough that you start having the whole rotating of the thing around, that the seventh month is actually the seventh month of the old calendar is actually the first month of the new calendar. So thus you start seeing some of the themes that show up not only from talking about the flood, but also about all of the then appointed times that follow on after that start to take on a kind of a layered meaning on it. Because thus, what was the seventh month in the old calendar is now the first month of the new calendar. And people go, well, who cares? All right, so you've got those people over in Mesopotamia. They've got it. They've got the whole thing that's like off by 7 months, and it's just rotated the thing around by 7 months. Who cares? It is interesting and to note for the, as I was mentioning earlier, with the exiles. When the exiles from Israel went to where? They were taken to Mesopotamia, Babylon. That's where you had a large group of them were taken. Some of them were taken by Assyria, and some of them ended up in Assyria, and then some of them were just scattered over who knows where from all the northern tribes of Israel. They were taken into Assyria and who knows where. The ones from the southern kingdom called Yehuda or Judah, they were taken to Babylon, and then with the holdovers there into Persia, and finally left around there by the time of where Greece came along. But still, you're taken back to a land that has their whole thing set 7 months different from where the original one was before. So the interesting thingly, and a lot of people try to make a lot of hay out of this by saying, well, you know, we should have a Shabbat, you know, just every 7 days, no matter what it is. And just every 7 days is a Shabbat. There's no sort of like any kind of like reset. Or we should have a new moon every four Shabbats. And that should be the returning part of it. And then you've got these holdover dates in between. Why? Because in Mesopotamia, that's the way they did it. Their whole thing was based upon sevens. The seven this, seven that, seven this, seven that. So thus you have all these people from Israel, they come in and are saying, now this is the beginning of months for you. And that is what they are holding to. That's coming up in the Babylonians' seventh month. This is the beginning of months. A very interesting thing is that in the Babylonian, we were talking about a little bit with the flood before, on the base 60, calendar scheme and the way of numbering. Thus, you're starting to see things also related upon sixes as well. So, long story short, you're having a people that are moving in, and or I should say moving in, they were hauled in, they were brought against their will into Mesopotamia with a completely different frame of reference for where time worked. And also a different frame of reference for where things began and moved through as a testimony for where the whole society is going. And why does that make any difference to us today? Well, think about it. You know, we all live with the calendars that's sitting on our wall or on our phone or this or that. We've got this calendar. But then we also recognize a different calendar, right? We have the calendar for when the appointed times of the Lord come from. And what does that do for you? you can, and people take different approaches to it. They can kind of say, well, it's kind of my cultural, my cultural history of it. And so I recognize these days that go by and that really doesn't sort of orient my life anymore. But what if you actually adhere to this calendar that is different from the one of the general society you're in? I mean, think about with Shabbat. Shabbat is a time that is supposed to be set aside. That's what the word says. You set aside this time because the Lord set it aside. So thus you start taking yourself out of the realm. Even though you are in the world, you're still sort of out of the world in the same time period. You have this frame of reference of where time is and where time goes. But you're also seeing this time flowing in a different way with the appointed times of the Lord. So thus, we can live in the world, because when someone says, okay, I want to see you on next Thursday, the such and such date. Okay, we know what that date is. And if we make an agreement, we're going to meet them. We meet them on that day. It's not like we have this calendar that's totally separate and we just adhere to whatever it would be on our calendar. We still are living in this world that may be completely oblivious to, you know, where things came from, where they're actually going in the whole world. But we still can observe these appointed times of the Lord. So when the Lord sets an appointment, we actually show up for the appointment. So thus, that's just a small example of where, when you see the Yeshua is praying there in his final prayer for his believers there in John chapter 14, 15, 16, 17, and he's specifically talking about them, that they are going to be in the world, but not of the world, that they are to do what to the world? That they are to change the world by being in the world. Because what can happen with, if you come from a different culture and you go to a separate culture, but you do nothing to preserve the culture from which you come? What eventually happens over time? Assimilation, we call that, a big old word for that, assimilation. You lose that which you came from. So the thing is that how can you thus be both in a culture that's different, but also preserving the culture that you came from? And a lot of people will say, well, you go through a filtering process, right? You say, what is it from the place that I come from that I want to keep, that should be kept? What is it from the place that I'm going do I want to keep? We see examples from the Bible, for example, like Lot. Lot was one who was certainly moved into a quite different culture than what he had come from, but still maintained a separateness from it. You can, people will debate how separate he was from the culture of Sodom that he was in, but he was obviously seen as, the heaven saw him as being different. He was righteous in that, what? And so did the people. And you see that in specifically in what they say to him, you know, have you come to be a judge, to a judge over us, because you're different, you're a foreigner, and still keep your distinctiveness? So that is an interesting lesson for us today, is that what are the things that we should be keeping from the culture that we come from, the culture of the Bible, in a world that may give a rip about anything that relates to the Bible? And you see, what has happened is a bit of a real struggle that's happened in our societies here that were very rooted in the Bible. And we just celebrated Thanksgiving, which goes back to a time of the Pilgrims. Now, the Pilgrims, if you go back and you read the historical account of it, when they came over in the Mayflower, you may think, well, everybody was a pilgrim on it. No, it was actually a small percentage of it. I think there's roughly about 30% of the people who were on the Mayflower were actually those folk that came from or fleeing first from England, then to Holland, and then from Holland to came over to the United States. But what did those 30% do to the rest of the people on the ship? That's where we get, when you read the Mayflower Compact that they came up with, that was an agreement. How are we then going to live together? But even those, that would be 70% of the people who were on the ship that did not, they weren't as really enthused about the connection to God as much as the pilgrims were, they still assented to this. Because it's very interesting, some of what you see in the accounts of the time period, the 70% varied from those people that just really didn't care to whatever, to the people who were somewhat hostile to what the pilgrims believed. But they're like, they could take it or leave it, but the pilgrims, that's why they were on the boat. They were in the boat because they could not take it or leave it. They had to leave because the places where they were at just said, nope, you can't live this way. You can't act this way. You can't believe this way anymore. So they just said, well, I've got to leave and then go to somewhere else. And then eventually, oh, I got to leave there and go to somewhere that was completely different. So then, you know, we are here, you know, come four centuries later, we look at this place that we live in here in the United States, and it was founded upon the ideals that were in that originally in the Mayflower Compact, and then grew up out of that as other people started coming over and from Europe and such. Well, what are the things that we want to keep, and what are the things that need to go away? And there are a number of things that were practices of Europe that just had to go away. You know, one of the ideas was the idea of a king, that you would be beholden to somebody that's in a family that would just rule over everybody and just keep ruling from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. Those were one things that they saw from the culture that they came from over in Europe and England and such. Now we're not going to continue that on anymore. But we as believers, what is it that we want to take with us from the Bible into the world around us? Now the situations, whether we're talking about Noah's time or Abraham's time or Moshe's time or any of the patriarchs, the apostles, those times are different. You know, those places where they were living, different, the culture's different, etc. But what was it that the connection from God that they were protecting from one generation to the next? And that was the same thing that was being protected in the boat. That legacy that started with Eve, that there would be the one to come through to crush the head of the snake. That is the basis, the core of it, and then gets built on and revealed. And as we will continue going on in Genesis, they'll keep building and building and building, that we get to know the one who was looking to restore, to turn the world around from the disaster and violence that led up to the flood to moving toward a world of peace. But the problem is that the world may not want to go that direction. Why? Because, you know, like we were mentioning a couple weeks ago with the problem of evil, when you start turning the light on and you say, this is what good, this is what is good, this is what is bad, what happens then with the behavior that ends up people realizing, what we're doing is bad? From the 50,000 or the million foot view of it, well, then you're faced with a choice. Do I continue doing this or not? Because thus, when you see the those deciding points that, like with Moshe, as he's up there on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, choose which way you're going to go. Choose life. You want the mount of blessing, or do you want the mount of cursing? There's no being in the valley anymore. So we, just like and use the example of just being on having a calendar that is, you have appointments with the creator of heaven and earth, even though you live in a culture that has a completely different calendar. You have instructions from the creator of heaven and earth, even though you live in a society that may have completely different instructions, some of which, as we here live in California, have instructions that go completely counter to the creator of heaven and earth and the way that people are created and how they actually are, etc. How you treat with morality, how you treat with justice, and on and on and on it goes. It can be quite different. So thus, as we continue to move through the Torah, we'll continue to run up against this. What we have in our instructions from the creator of heaven and earth versus the society that we're living in. So what ends up being our being found righteous, being found a tzaddik in the generation that we are in? Whether we're a Noach, whether we're a Lot, whether we're an Avraham, the friend of God, who hears that voice out of the midst of the cacophony, the buffet of beliefs there in Mesopotamia at the time period, and would follow on. So any last thoughts or questions, observations from the passages we looked over here today as we close things out? Yes, Carrie, go ahead, please.
This is kind of just for fun.
Oh, I love those.
So the day that's listed for when the ark rested on Mount Ararat.
Yes.
Seems to correspond to John 7:14, because it's right in the middle of Sukkot.
Ah, yes.
And right Very in the middle of Sukkot is a day that Messiah went and taught in the temple. It was when he delayed going to the Feast of Sukkot.
Interesting, yes.
I just thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, it is. It is a very interesting thing about when you think about the ark and what it represents. Basically, taking all of that which needs to be protected and restored, and delivering it through the judgment. And I see Larry. Larry, you got your hand up there. Go ahead, please.
It sounds to me like when he changed it to the 6th month being the first month. That's what it was, the 6th, right?
7th month,
that, yeah. He was setting it up for the age of the Messiah, which would be the one that Eve was promised was going to come in and crush the serpent's head.
That's a great observation. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's a good one.
This belongs to the Messiah now. From now on, the point of creation is going to be to get it back to where God designed it in the first place.
Mm. Wow. Oh, great. Thank you. Any other observations that we have here as we close out? John, yes.
That maybe there's a difference between starting with months versus when the year starts. So it's is it possibly like almost two different calendars, like a calendar of when you start the months and another calendar of when you start the years?
Ah, yeah. And that brings a very interesting point, because what you'll see, and that becomes a question of when we get down to the time of like Jubilees and the cycle of the Shemitah or the sabbatical years, and also the years of what they talk about when the kings reigned and such. Those still get tied to what becomes the 7th month of the new Israel's calendar. Those are all still kind of keyed down to the same month where Yom Kippur and all that stuff. Those are considered to be the starting points for kingly rules for the Jubilee years get declared there to start the following year, etc. So yeah, it's a very interesting point where you do still have those in certain cases still consist and still can continue to move on with the starting point still being in what became the seventh month of Israel's calendar. Yes, Carrie. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, I kind of, this is because I know we don't know dates for sure, but in the idea of Messiah being born in the seventh month, then it almost works with that prophetically. Because it's like if his life started at that time of the year, but then our life started at Passover with his sacrifice. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's another great point. You have the Messiah potentially being born there in the seventh month of Israel's calendar, but that would be like the first month of the old calendar. That's an interesting point too. Yes, John, go ahead, please.
Just remind, when did that switch happen?
When did the switch happen?
Yeah.
Oh, it's found in Exodus chapter 12, when right during the whole time of the plagues and such like this, and you're seeing it talking about with the discussion of the Passover, and it's revealed there, this is going to be the beginning of months for you. And it's why its other name is called, this is the month of Aviv. And Aviv has various translations that go from it. Some, it's akin to the greening of ears, meaning the greening of the ears of the barley. So it's some people will say the tradition of grounding it to the timing of the barley harvest. But so that's where you see that shift happening is right at the Exodus. And that's very thing that what Carrie was talking about. It's like beginning of the Messiah and beginning of the people redeemed by the Messiah. And that's people of God and that movement that you can see Israel is in a sense, sort of like with the recession of the floodwaters. And that's why you see throughout history that baptism, this immersion of where, you're washing away your old way of life is often depicted in connection with the ark, because that is sort of where you're like boarding the ark is you're washing away your old way of life, just the way that the flood washed away the old world before the flood. So thus your baptism, that washing away is what's then you are now into the ark, being the Messiah is now carrying you through the flood. So it's a very interesting point because you get to where you see that in further on in Revelation, there's the point that it's stressed a few times that those who hold to the commandments of God and the testimony of Yeshua. So that is seen also as like that is what that trust that they have carries them through the whole tumult of the day of the Lord and all of the tumult, just like the Teva, the ark, carried Noah and his family and the animals through the tumult of the flood. So Yeshua then correct in saying that the days of the Son of Man being like the days of Noah.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.